Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, and joining me tonight as tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst, Dean Johnson. 3 weeks ago, we began a conversation about a topic that's close to our hearts, animal law, and asked the question about whether animals have rights. Tonight, we continue that discussion. Dean?
Good evening, everyone. You know, once again, we get to delve into the laws surrounding our beloved furry friends. Tonight, we hope to have a discussion on two levels. First of all, continuing our discussion from the last show, we ask, do animals really have rights? Or is talk about animal rights just an expression of our own natural empathy as humans for the suffering of other creatures? And second, we will get very practical and talk about the protections that animals actually have and the cutting-edge cases in which our guests are involved, where those protections have been, where they are now, and where they may go in the future. Jeffrey.
And of course, as Dean pointed out, the world of animals goes far beyond the companion animals we've taken in as our extended families. You know, there's animals either used for food, for labor, and myriad foods, medicines, and medical procedures are developed after first testing them on animals. Arguably, some such testing may or may not be necessary, but some may be, and perhaps others less so. There are wild animals who are moving into areas we think of reserved for human activities. Likewise, there are people who venture into areas full of wildlife, who observe or to hunt or to fish. Dean?
And as always, our panel of outstanding guests is here to guide us through the wild world of animal law. Jeffrey.
We want to invite you listeners, that is our most important guest, to join in our conversation. Our phone number right here, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our guests are here to educate. They're not here to provide precise legal advice about a particular case. And the opinions expressed here don't necessarily reflect the opinions of their employers, their clients, or KALW. Our number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, anything relating to animal laws or even animal rights. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Dean?
And our guests tonight are from the University of Denver Stern College of Law, where he serves as Director of Strategic Initiatives, Animal Activist Legal Defense Project, Carter Dillard, worked previously as the Animal Legal Defense Fund Director of Litigation, during which time he helped quadruple the number of cases the organization had filed and helped oversee its first undercover investigations.
Corey Page is the founding partner of Evans & Page, with a portfolio of cases and clients that displays the spectrum of legal approaches and issues involved in improving the lives of animals. Evans & Page represents the nation's premier animal advocacy organization. Mr. Page was an adjunct professor of animal law at Santa Clara University and at the University of San Francisco. Corey is a regular speaker at national conferences and has been interviewed by Los Angeles Times Magazine, National Public Radio, local and national newspapers, and of course, right here on this show, Dean.
And last but most assuredly not least, Deborah Press. Deborah is an associate general counsel for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, having previously worked as director of regulatory affairs for the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, better known as the ASPCA. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture, enforcing animal welfare statutes focusing primarily on the Animal Welfare Act enforcement against animal research institutions and zoos.
And with that, Carter, Corey, Deborah, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great to be here, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Dean.
So, as our audience knows, I always like to start off with the big question. And I'm going to throw this out to all three of you. You know, I did a little research during the week, and animal rights is not a new idea. I mean, some people say it's been around since the 3rd century in Buddhist and Hindu literature. There are all sorts of philosophers who've weighed in on the subject of animal rights, and from many different perspectives. I mean, we have utilitarian arguments, we have Kantian arguments, we have religious arguments, emotional arguments. I'd just like to get your personal perspective. How do you see animal rights? Where does it come from? And you know, what is the status of animal rights in your personal mind and your personal experience? And anybody who wants to start, start. Corey.
Yeah. Thank you, Dean.
You're welcome.
Well, I think culturally in America, we have struggled with an idea of animal rights. And as we talked about on the last program, I think the phrase animal rights is fraught with complications, because an easy way to think about animal rights would be just what limits do we have on humans' abuse of animals? What are we allowed and not allowed to do to animals right now? Another version of animal rights could be like, what do they come with inherently as a being on the planet? You know, if you believe in religion under God, or morally or ethically. And so when we talk about animal rights, everyone comes at that phrase with a different idea. And so I think it's easier just to talk about animal rights in terms of what does the law protect and doesn't protect? Because that's how I practice law. And I think we've had a tough time with animals in America because it has always loomed the question of if we give a little more and respect a little more of these beings' interests and protect them from harm, where will that lead us in terms of can we still eat them? Can we still use their pelts or their skin, or can we use them for animal testing? So it has been this give and take with what limits we would want to put on human behavior. Where I think it's going, I maybe optimistically, but it does seem to be that we are recognizing the beauty and intelligence and wonder that is the animal kingdom around us, and how it mimics how we interact with the world, our own emotional spectrum. And so it seems like we're starting to give more respect. And when I say respect, I mean legal protection. And therefore, I mean limits on human behavior.
But, you know, to that end, it seems that when we look at the law, certainly in California, and I would imagine most states even more so, we're talking about animals. We're talking about, for example, our own pets. The law doesn't treat them as family and people. It treats them like property. So if I were to go and it's hard for me to say this because anybody who knows me knows I would never do it. But if I went and did something that hurt the neighbor's dog, any prosecution would be closer to me stealing the next door neighbor kid's bicycle than it would to me striking the next door neighbor kid.
Yeah, but it's bending. So like if you were to go like 15 years ago, like let's take your car and let's say I smash up your car and then you sue me for the damage to your car. And then you say, look, I took my car to the auto body shop and I spent $40,000 getting my 84 Corolla fixed. You wouldn't be able to get that in a lawsuit because they'd say, look, we're just going to give you Blue Book. That was unreasonable for you to spend that much to get your 84 Corolla fixed. So we'll give you Blue Book. However, about 10 years ago, the law bent on animals because it was the same way before. And the law said, look, if you take your dog to the vet and they need extraordinary care And it goes up to $30,000, $40,000 for someone's negligence, even though that far exceeds anyone's version of fair market value or blue book for an animal. We are going to allow you to get compensation for that quote unquote repair for your property. Now, that is indicative of the fact that the law is recognizing that it's not just normal property.
You know, to that end, when I was growing up, I would pass by a neighbor who had a dog chained in their front yard. And back then, I assumed that chaining a dog was legal. In fact, I had a family member, a distant family member, whose dog actually jumped the fence while chained and hung herself. And back in those days, there was never a question of legality, never a question of animal cruelty. It was strictly, you know, sorry, you messed up. Is that still the case today? Is chaining a dog now illegal, or is it legal?
You know, I think it depends on where you are. I think there are city ordinances. You know, I'm thinking back to my time at ASPCA, and I do think there are city ordinances that prevent chaining, that prohibit chaining. And so it depends on where you are. It depends what city you live in. Those are mostly local laws. So, I mean, and that kind of taps back into something Corey said. It's not the rights, however you define that, of an animal aren't even, you can't even say that a dog has these rights and a cow has these rights, because it matters, you know, are you a dog in South Carolina? Are you a dog in San Francisco? And, you know, just piggybacking on what Corey said about how much you can receive in damages for a pet. If let's say your cat dies after you incur all of those medical expenses. When I was at the USDA enforcing the Animal Welfare Act, my very first case there was against an animal research institution where a cat had died, a cat that was being used for research, and it had been killed by the negligence of a staff person. And I was able to fine that research institution $5,000 for the death of that cat. So again, like we don't have a prevailing philosophy about what the rights of animals are. It absolutely, as Corey says, depends on where you're located geographically, what this animal is used for. Even the species doesn't confer a set of rights. It really all depends on how humans have chosen to exploit or value these different animals.
Now, aren't we, though, kind of culturally crazy and even a little schizophrenic about animals? I mean, for example, Jeff is very pure. Jeff is vegan and is very kind to animals. I'm not. I will eat meat. On the other hand, I'll take a spider and sweep her onto a newspaper and carry her out of my house so I don't have to kill her. Aren't we just... you know, aren't we as a culture kind of schizophrenic about the way we treat animals? And isn't that reflected in the law? I mean, we see animals as property, but we see animals as rights bearing creatures as well.
I think it's not just animals, though, Dean. I think it's with all facets of human behavior that if you have to do it yourself, you weigh the ethics and you often make the right decision. But if you don't have to do it yourself, then it is just a product. So if you have to go kill an animal and hunt an animal and live with that and look at that animal and clean the animal, you might feel different about eating meat. Just like you do when you have to kill a spider and you have to, that weighs on you, even though it's small and you don't even recognize the behavior patterns. You don't even recognize the emotions or the eyes. It's not even laid out the same as you, whereas, you know, other animals are that we don't have a problem eating because they're already prepackaged and the death happens so far away that we don't have to face it. And I think that's true with, you know, whatever it is, whether you're buying things that are made with, you know, child labor or whatever, if you do things and you don't have to see the consequences, even if you're told about it, you can plug along and live with that. But if you have to be involved in initiating those consequences, I think it's much harder as humans to do that. Carter,
and as we discussed last time, things philosophy, are so cleaned though. Up. And as we discussed last time, things are so cleaned up and trimmed when we buy them in the market. Absent and aside from fish, and even with most fish, most things are not recognizable as a human creature. You've got this slab of tissue. You wouldn't see that this was once a cow. You wouldn't see that this pig was actually friendly and answered to its name and came to the house occasionally. You just see a slab of bacon or whatever it might be.
I think it's, I want to hear what Carter has to say about this, but I think it's interesting how even when you use the language, we do what we're saying we're doing. It's meta. We create words because we don't want to say a slab of pig. We say we create words that represent products that are different from the animal. So we wouldn't say we take a chunk of pig. You say you created the word bacon, which kind of makes it easier because that's the food product. Like it's just an easier way to talk about animals without actually, like, you get a steak and you get like, it's just easier to do that for a human to make those choices than to actually say the words of what you're doing.
Yeah, we have an extraordinary power for abstracting. I remember I was down in Half Moon Bay one time, and there was a family there, and a little girl was picking out a crab from one of the fishing boats. And she said, I'm going to call the crab George. And the fisherman says, no, 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 don't give it a name. If you give it a name, you'll never cook it and eat it. And we just have that ability to abstract. And I think the industries that live off of killing animals, frankly, really encourage that abstraction, don't they?
Corey had asked, I mean, I think it's easy for reasonable people to agree that we should not cause animals suffering, and maybe even that we should promote their autonomy so they could make choices and have a free life. The breakdown, so that agreement creates obligations that we not harm them, that we try to liberate them. That's a right. Our recognition of that obligation is a moral right. It's when the legal system, the political system, gets involved that we have to sort of choose between allocation of resources. Which wrongs are we going to use the system to address? And animals fall to the bottom because we, as we've all been talking about, we rely on them and we use them. But in terms of where animal law might go, there are not a lot of silver linings to the climate crisis. But one thing is clear, treating the non-human world as a human resource has now backfired and will kill millions of humans. So now is the opportunity to say, oh, the non-human world may not be property that we should own and over which we should have unlimited control.
You know, and you touch on the fact that you guys are very much crusaders. You're out there on the edge trying to push and expand the scope of what we can call animal rights, however defined. But there really are entrenched interests who don't want to see that happen. I think, Deborah, we talked before we came on air about a case you're doing with the University of California right now, right?
Yeah, that and this one, and Corey is involved with also. This is a case brought by the Physicians Committee against University of California, Davis, to obtain some public records.
And there are some very powerful people involved in this, yes?
Yeah, so Elon Musk's brain implant company, Neuralink, had contracted with UC Davis's Primate Research Center to conduct some early, some preliminary research in the development of their brain implant. And we know from some hard-won records that we requested that there was a lot of suffering by these. These were rhesus macaque monkeys, and they had screws drilled into their skulls, and many of them developed infections and were ultimately euthanized because of unplanned medical problems in the course of this research. And the, you know, as you know, we've read in the media, a lot of Elon Musk companies are perform work that's very rushed, that doesn't very rushed, very a little bit negligent often. And that seems to be the case here. But what we're trying to do is fight for transparency, because when Neuralink left UC Davis, they took a lot of the records with them. And specifically, they took some photos and potentially some videos of these animals. And, you know, as we said, when something like animal research is sanitized and people don't see what it looks like, they're more accepting of it and are less likely to object to it and consider alternatives. So that's what we're trying to do here, is to open up a window into what went on and to see some of the heartbreaking images of these animals that were used for this, were used very unnecessarily for this research.
Yeah, I got to say, the concept of brain implants sounds a little nightmarish to me, but I'm sure they have a useful function. How would you respond to the people who say brain implants could be a medical breakthrough? It could be great for humans who have brain injuries or, you know, whatever difficulty. And so the sacrifice of these test animals is worth it.
You know, I'm far from a brain implant expert, but the common thread that we see with animal research is that it's generally unnecessary. It's been going on. It's been used for decades, centuries, probably. And if anything, it's holding us back in terms of scientific innovation and medical progress. There's so much research out there that shows that significant technological advancements have been hung up by animal research, that animal research does not produce human relevant medical interventions. You know, the FDA and the National Institutes of Health have recognized that 95% of all pharmaceuticals fail during human clinical trials after appearing safe in animals. We see similar statistics when it comes to Alzheimer's drugs. Like researchers at the Cleveland Clinic have said that 99.6% of Alzheimer's drugs that pass animal tests failed human trials. So this is a process. The use of animals is failing people. It's a dichotomy that's just false. We don't need animal tests to help people. We need to eliminate animal tests so that we can help people, because it's really just, it's holding back our innovation and our medical progress.
Yeah. So we're talking about here what we mentioned before, which is unnecessary suffering. And that's what you're trying to eliminate.
Exactly. And there are, you know, there are many forms of non-invasive brain. I forget what they call it. They call the technology, but they're trying to create technology that allows a person to control a computer with their brain. And that can be done in a non-invasive manner. You don't have to drill into the skulls of monkeys in order to develop that technology. You just have to think beyond the paradigm that we've become accustomed to, and that in reality is holding back our progress.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by tonight's co-host, Dean Johnson. And tonight we're discussing animal law with Deborah Press, Associate General Counsel for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, Carter Dillard from the University of Denver Stern College of Law, and from Evans and Page, Corey Page. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic of animal law. You don't have to jump in at the exact point we may be in our conversation. Deborah, let me back up a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine? I mean, it seems we talked a little bit about your background and coming through you've had some very interesting stops in the way, and how you got to this Physicians Committee is what interests me.
Yeah, the Physicians Committee comes at animal protection from the perspective of the medical field. Our founder is Neil Barnard. He's an MD, and he wanted to address the use and exploitation of animals that he encountered as a physician. So the Physicians Committee advocates for preventive medicine via plant-based diets, so diets that don't involve the consumption of animals. So, you know, that directly addresses the exploitation of animals in animal agriculture, but it also happens to be a healthy diet that prevents a lot of chronic diseases. The Physicians Committee supports higher ethical standards in research and medical research. As I discussed earlier, we think that good medical research doesn't involve animals. And we also conduct our own clinical research because we think that there needs to be some research out there that combats a lot of the industry-funded nutrition research, but also a lot of the research that, you know, that many researchers claim can't be done without the use of animals.
So a couple of you guys are actually, we're talking about the vested interests that don't necessarily want to see an expansion of animal rights. You guys are involved in a battle with the dairy industry, right?
Yes. And this is something another case that we've partnered with Corey's firm on. We filed a case last month on behalf of a 17-year-old LA high school student who wanted to criticize the dairy industry at school. And she's a vegan and an animal activist and wanted to educate her peers about some of the harms that she sees with dairy. She cares about the environment. She cares about animals. And there are all kinds of equity issues with dairy. There's a huge, you know, most people of color can't digest lactose, and yet milk is required to be offered at every school meal and as a part of the school lunch program. So she wanted to educate her peers, but she was denied permission to do that at school by her principal, unless she also promoted dairy milk. And we believe the likely reason for that was a federal law that prohibits any restriction on the marketing of milk as a part of the school meals. So, you know, we don't blame the school district. I think they were aware of this law and they believe their hands were tied. But this just is sort of the most outrageous example of how closely intertwined the dairy industry is with USDA, which the USDA is an agency that's in charge of feeding our children healthy meals at school. But what they're really doing frequently is using that position to promote unhealthy foods that are often produced in inhumane and environmentally devastating ways. So this lawsuit's allowed us to bring that relationship to light and to talk about the inequity of milk in the school meal programs and talk about the health problems with dairy. So it should be an interesting case.
Yeah, listening to your legal rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Early, I wanted to give you a moment to tell us a little bit about your area of practice. You've had some very interesting cases of late, and I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that before you go.
Wow. Thanks, Jeff. As you know, we started our practice about 2 decades ago when my partner, Geneva Page, was working as basically a lobbyist, representative for a nonprofit animal group in Sacramento. And she developed relationships, and we got to know personally a lot of these people. And thanks to her, we were able to grow the practice out of that. And our current practice, as Deborah says, we're doing a lot of cases regarding food policy and the ability to know about what's in your food and speak about food. And a lot of our cases have to do with that, learning about and being told about what's going on and being able to speak about it. And that covers, like Deborah was talking about, the Regents case about what's happening with the animals, just wanting to learn about what's happening there, or the other case about dairy at school, being able to talk about it, talk about maybe what's bad or what's a better alternative to drinking milk. We also, as we talked about the last program, have a great case. And I want Carter to talk a little bit more about it too, because he's involved, is the donkey case, where we are suing a number of entities for selling and promoting Ajayo, a herbal medicine that is pilled form or powdered form of donkey hide. And one of the defendants is actually the acupuncture board in California, because on their testing materials, they actually talk about how you need to know when to prescribe this Ajayo. And so in a way, they're giving the blessing to would-be acupuncturists who want to learn and get, you know, their license, and they have to learn and know when to prescribe it, when in reality, they shouldn't be prescribing it at all, because it's not supposed to be sold here or used here in California. So yeah, cases like this are a pleasure to be involved with and an honor. And I appreciate people like Deborah and Carter who are one step in front and helping us find these cases.
Yeah, Carter, you know, we certainly appreciate all of you guys and your effort in taking on these huge interests, but let's take it down to street level. What can our listeners do? What can people in general do to assist in the struggle for animal rights? What can we do on a daily basis?
I mean, I think there are at least three things that everybody could do. One is to offer their services to existing animal protection organizations, whether as a volunteer, some attorneys do pro bono service. But I think going into the structure is one way to do it. A second way is sort of a grassroots approach, which is if you read about some form of animal abuse, some form of exploitation, you can focus on that area as a citizen and try to expose what's going on, reporting it to the authorities, reporting it to your representatives. And sometimes a grassroots approach is a great way to go. And a third way is, you know, like it or not, we vote with our wallets. So as consumers, we can try to avoid industries that exploit and abuse animals. Corey had mentioned the Ajayo case. California has a prohibition on the sale of equine products. There are companies blatantly violating that prohibition and making a lot of money. You mentioned the schizophrenia before. Probably that prohibition should be on reducing any living, loving creature to a product. But for now, it's focused on equine products. And so, you know, one thing you could do is essentially stop consuming animal products, because that is in some ways the source of their suffering.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, it seems like the main impact that most of us have is we actually go to the store and we buy animal products. Should we be boycotting the dairy industry? Should we all go vegan? Is that a moral imperative or it's something pragmatic that we can and should do?
I'm sure Deborah has great thoughts on this. It is effective. The industries are animal abuse industries are losing market share. It's easy to do. There are alternative to animal products that are popping up all of the time. I think that, you know, for those reasons, it almost becomes gratuitous that we would cause suffering if we have these alternatives. They're healthier, they're better for the environment, and they avoid animal suffering. So I think that makes sense. One final thought is, you know, ending animal suffering through changing the way we consume is great, but it really shouldn't be up to consumers whether animals are tortured and killed. It should be prohibited by law. It should be coercively prohibited by law. And so while, you know, market reforms are great, we do need legal reforms that essentially prohibit the mistreatment of animals. And so we can't just rely on markets.
Yeah. And Deborah, aren't we kind of lagging behind here in California? I mean, you just told us about research on rhesus monkeys. I understand that there are some countries that have actually banned research using primates. Is it true or not?
I have to admit, I'm not up to speed on the international, on the international status of that. So our focus is here. But I will say, generally speaking, the California is ahead of the curve in terms of the United States. I mean, California just banned the use of animals in cosmetics testing a couple of years ago. California, different cities in California are doing great things, increasing plant-based alternatives in school food, in hospitals, in prisons. That's another case we actually worked on with Corey in the last couple of years, another First Amendment case defending a prisoner's right to get plant-based food in California state penitentiaries. So California is doing better than a lot of states by a long shot.
Yeah, and I understand that San Francisco several years ago became one of the first so-called no-kill cities where our animal shelters actually don't euthanize the animals. They try to find homes for everybody. So, yeah, maybe we are a little bit ahead. So you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we're discussing animal law. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415. 841-4134. Or if you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, you can call us on our dime at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you may ask any question regarding the subject, regardless of what we're talking about at the time.
And let me ask this to Carter, Deborah. What are your thoughts about zoo animals? Here are animals that we may bring to the zoo. Maybe they're treated well, but they're taken out of their environment. They're taken out of the wild and live the rest of their lives in a cage, much like people being put in jail. A related topic, or what about circus animals? Have they actually been banned finally? Oh, Deborah, you're shaking your head.
You know, Ringling Brothers went out of business. They stopped using animals a few years ago, finally, after many years of advocacy by the animal protection movement. But no, the Animal Welfare Act covers both zoo animals, circus animals, animals used in entertainment. We haven't talked about the Animal Welfare Act much yet on this call, but those are pretty paltry protections. They require things like water and food and sort of like that eyes be on the animals every day. I think a lot of people put a lot more stock in the Animal Welfare Act than they should. It doesn't do much to protect animals. It does almost nothing to actually provide for the quality of life of animals. And it's on top of that, it's actually an overstatement to say it's poorly enforced. It's basically unenforced by the USDA.
And I mean, one area of animal law that's overlooked often is local or municipal law that can often exceed the basement or the floor of state law and federal law. And so using local law is one effective way to get at circuses, other performing animal venues. In terms of zoos, I mean, I think one clear argument is that if they're there to educate, it's one thing if they're there truly to conserve and to restore wild populations, which is the case in some facilities, but oftentimes they are promoted as educational. But if you can think about it, really, that isn't truly educating people about how animals, those animals would live, the relationships they would have, the ecologies in which they would thrive. You're literally pulling them completely out of context. And with that taking out of context, you lose the educational value. We should be educating, you know, I think children that to truly understand animals, you have to understand them in the wild and understand their relationships, because that's who they are, not out of context. And I would think as we evolve that both performing animal venues and circuses will eventually become a thing of the past.
But what can we do individually? Clearly, if the market goes away, if people stop going to rodeos, there's not going to be that desire to, in my eyes, mistreat a lot of these same animals. Would you say the same applies to the other things? I mean, is it really a market solution, or are we really have some hope of a regulation at some point? And what can individuals do?
I want to recognize there might be a middle ground here. If there are market forces that are eliminating animal abuse because we have alternatives, the companies that are providing those alternatives have a market interest in eliminating cruelty. That interest may be more powerful than prosecutors' interest, or even the general public's interest. They have a business interest. And so one middle ground between regulation and market is to empower companies to sue, to enjoin acts of cruelty, because they're getting undercut oftentimes by that cruelty. That if a factory farm couldn't intensively confine animals, they wouldn't exist. And so people selling vegan products are actually being harmed by the fact that those animals are treated cruelly. So there might be a middle ground in terms of empowering humane businesses.
You know, I'm wondering, talking about zoos, is there a paradigm for zoos that could actually work for both humans and animals? I'm thinking about a zoo that I visited one time, Steve Irwin's Australia Zoo. And Irwin was a real advocate, in my mind, for animals. And he constructed this zoo where the animals were generally in their natural environment. In fact, I took a walk through the jungle with a tiger when I visited there. Is it possible to do things like zoos and still give animals the proper respect and a life that's consistent with animal rights?
Well, one possible answer is that it may not be, because you have to obtain the animals. The other would be, even if you've got multiple generations, the breeding process would probably not be the sort of things they would naturally engage in. The other is that a lot of the difference between sanctuaries and zoos often hinge on whether you can sell viewing of the animals to the public. And that's because oftentimes the animals' natural lives are interfered with by the way that they're displayed. So I think perhaps nature photography, nature cinematography, documentaries where the documentarians are minimally invasive, these might be more consistent than even the best zoos with animals living an autonomous life.
You know, obviously we have a lot of change and a lot of work to do. I'd like to ask you both about your wish list. If you could have your highest priorities in terms of changing the law or changing the culture, what would you want to see done?
I'm happy to start us off and then jump to Deborah. I think three things. One is, I think at this point, climate restoration should be our highest priority. At 2 degrees and climbing, the climate crisis will cause levels of animal and human suffering that could exceed anything we've seen in the past. And I think restoration is possible, just not politically favored. A second thing that I'm particularly interested in would be altering the way we see families through family reforms that try to build empathy in children. And you do that by treating children well. It's hard to think that humans would treat non-humans well if they themselves were not treated well as they were born and raised. So I think family reforms centered on building empathy in children would be a long-term solution to animal suffering. And then you guys had, I know you like the concrete, very specific legal reforms. I already told you, I think empowering humane businesses to enforce animal cruelty laws through civil injunctions is a pretty practical way to get around some of the political roadblocks that we see with animal cruelty prosecutions.
So should we be teaching animal rights in elementary school?
Well, it's in fact required. If you look at most states, they have humane education laws. Sometimes they're called character development laws. Those laws are almost never enforced. New York has an enforceable law, and it has been, organizations have tried to enforce that. I think, you know, a great bill for California would be to make California's humane education law enforceable. We've used that law to prevent school districts from bringing kids to the rodeo, because if you have to teach children about, instruct them in the humane treatment of animals, obviously showing them the antithesis doesn't comply with your legal obligations. So I think, you know, if we care about animals, we should care about the majority of animals, which are those who live in the future. And to get at them, we have to be good to kids.
Deborah, what do you think? What do we need to change?
I'll do my list of, I like how you did a list of three, Carter. I think first I would say a complete shift away from the use of animal models in animal research and medical research, pharmaceutical research, scientific research, and medical training. Sometimes it's just stunning to think where we could be now if we had been investing in, we've been investing in non-animal models for the last 10, 20, 50 years, where we would be in terms of disease treatment and medical advancements. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, awards more than $16 billion each year to research projects involving animals. Compare that to a mere $75 million over 3 years that it funded a tissue chips program, organs on chips. Which are groundbreaking devices with the potential to replace animals in pharmaceutical testing. So if we had just, for the last half a century, if we'd been dedicating those resources to something other than animal testing, it floors me to think where we could be and how many animal lives we could have saved and how much suffering we could have prevented. The second thing I would say is just a complete reorganization of the USDA. We have our agency that is tasked with promoting agriculture. It is also tasked with protecting animals and promoting health. And so there's just too many inherent conflicts of interest at USDA. We'd like to see the USDA, the Animal Welfare Act is an insufficient law, but it's not being enforced to the extent that it could be, even within its meager limits. So I think I would like to see the responsibility for animal welfare removed from USDA and responsibility for health and nutrition programs also removed from USDA, because for far too long, our health and nutrition programs have been created and developed with commodity promotion in mind. And that's the promotion of animal agriculture, like meat and milk. So I think those would be my big two.
You mentioned about the industry of animals for food, frankly, just animals for profit. Is being vegan a matter of health or a matter of morals, or maybe a combination of the two?
It's both. It's absolutely both. And it doesn't matter which way you come at it. I think sometimes every time I learn something new, I find a new reason to have a plant-based diet. The more we learn about climate change, that gives me more reasons. When I have an emotional reaction to the suffering of an animal that I see on the internet, or it just reinforces those ethical beliefs. So I think it's everything. It's anything. It's anything that speaks to you.
And Carter, I haven't asked you if you're necessarily vegetarian or vegan, but I'll ask you the same question. Is it, in your mind, a matter of morals or health or a little of both?
I mean, I think if the question is about the motivation, there are a lot of motivations. People can use health. They can use ethics. They might use impacts on the environment. Oftentimes, they're sort of following role models. But regardless, if you're not consuming the products, you're not causing suffering to innocent creatures. And you're also probably not degrading the environment that you yourself need to survive in the future. So, I mean, across the board, we would take any reason would people would get involved. But I think ideally, at least it would open a conversation to ethics, because we might realize that justice to animals might open our eyes to justice to other vulnerable categories, humans, or the environment. So justice, in some ways, talking about it and the ethics of it eventually can, I think, make us better people.
Well, I mentioned at the start of the show or before we went on air that I would give each of you a few minutes for any closing or final thoughts you had. Let me start with Deborah. Do you want to take a couple minutes, 3 minutes or so? Tell us any final thoughts you have.
I would encourage any attorneys out there who are interested in this work, reach out to us, reach out to the Physicians Committee. There's really no such thing as animal law. We employ every strategy that we possibly can. We use administrative complaints. We could use shareholder activist strategies. We could use class action lawsuits, consumer protection statutes, civil rights statutes, like these First Amendment cases that we're working on with Corey. So if you're an attorney who's interested in working to help animals, you likely have the skills to do that already. And we'd love to work with you, so please reach out. And I think the same goes for non-lawyers. If you are a 17-year-old high school student and you care about these issues, there's something you can do. If you are a parent of a student in schools, there's something you can do. And I think everybody has an important voice to lend to animal protection and animal advocacy. And we want to work with you. We know it's exhausting to fight cruelty and injustice. It's everywhere. It's not just animals. But organizations like the Physicians Committee are here to help. And we have the resources and expertise to help fight those fights. So I would encourage everybody to visit our website, pcrm.org. And reach out if you'd like to join our movement.
Carter, you mentioned you wanted 4 or 5 minutes yourself. Go ahead.
I'll just say briefly. PCRM is a wonderful organization, and there are lots of organizations that are doing great work. Large organizations can have sort of a top-down approach because they're filled with people that are professional, highly educated, oftentimes specializing in the field. That may, in some ways, shadow a little bit the possibility of a grassroots animal rights movement, where everyday people simply possessed of their moral sentiments might know about animal mistreatment or want to do something about it. And so oftentimes, the bar for people doing the right thing, investigating a situation of animal abuse, whistleblowing at a company, maybe in some cases trying to rescue animals that are suffering. The bar to them doing that is that they fear prosecution, they fear criminal ramifications. So I work with several attorneys at the University of Denver, a new project called the Animal Activist Legal Defense Project. And the idea is to remove that barrier, to offer criminal defense services to animal activists around the country to tell their stories. And to explain that, look, as we talked about in the beginning, I think reasonable people would agree we should not treat animals poorly. And if we can simply awaken that sentiment in people and remove their fear of being prosecuted for investigating, rescuing, doing other things to help animals, we might rise up as a bit of a grassroots movement And so the hope is to essentially inspire legal but bold behavior, because every social justice movement in the end comes from the grassroots. So thanks for asking.
And some of the legal attacks that, Deborah, you mentioned earlier, not necessarily moving straight on through an animal law type approach, but as one example you said is dealing with the work at UC Davis through a First Amendment lawsuit. Thinking outside the box, if so to speak.
Yeah, it's an incredibly creative area of law. You use because the laws are so limited, because it's so hard to get standing on behalf of animals, because we have so few ways of challenging the institutions that harm animals in the regular course of business, we have to be very creative. And it's never boring.
Dean Johnson, do you have any last minute thoughts on the subject?
Yeah, you know, it's a very complex subject, but I think the bottom line is I agree with the late Harvard philosopher Robert Nozick, who wrote a lot about animal rights. And what Nozick said was that there are animal rights, but those animal rights are really derivative from our status as human beings, because when we as people tolerate unnecessary suffering, not only among humans, but among animals, that diminishes us as people. And I am so pleased that these warriors are out there fighting the battle for animal rights and doing such a great job against such powerful interests, because they're not only fighting for animal rights, they're fighting for our dignity as human beings.
And there is so much that each of us can do. Even if you're not going to be vegetarian or vegan, even if you don't want to go and walk into labs and rescue animals, there's so much you could do that makes an incremental difference, whether you go to work with a rescue group and help take puppies that have been overbred and maybe making them adoptable, getting them into stores, getting them into people's hands, or feeding them or fostering them or whatever it may be. If you really care about animals, there's a role for everyone, and everything you do adds to the solution. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we revisited our discussion of animal law. Our guests tonight have been Carter Dillard from the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, Corey Page, founding partner of Evans & Page, and Deborah Press, Associate General Counsel for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And joining me is tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst, Dean Johnson. Our show tonight has been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. Thanks again to our guest, and to all of you for joining us. And for Dean Johnson, and back at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and be safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.